Welcome to Think Orphan, the podcast for orphan excellence. Real talk with real people navigating the global orphan crisis.
Welcome back to the Think Orphan podcast. My name is Brandon Stiver, and I hope that you are having a wonderful summer. As we have just recently recapped 200 episodes, you guys heard that recording last month. We're just looking over, man, all these amazing guests that we have had over the last 200 episodes. And, you know, there's a lot of different themes that we kind of go through. So as we're in these summer months, we're going to spend some time, August and September, just looking back at some of these great people that we've had join us on the Think Orphan podcast. And we really couldn't think of a better place to start than looking at some of the care leaders, care leavers, people that have experienced care and yet now are advocating, are leading great work within child care, child welfare, and of course, care reform. So that's what we're going to be doing today. We got some great guests that you have heard, but maybe haven't heard in a while. And we're going to be leading off actually with our friend Nabs from Helping Children Worldwide. Nabs is just a great guy. He's a passionate advocate and a leader within this space. So I'm excited just to get into this first segment where we are talking with Mohammed Nabiu, also known as Nabs.
I grew up in a very poor village in the community in West Africa, Sierra Leone. My family, my mom and dad, we are really poor. They could not afford to send me to school. But my dream was always to go to school because I wanted to be able to go to school and become educated and come out to be able to impact the society and, you know, help transform the face of the world in my own way. You know, it takes time. So my dad used to always promise me that, Nabs, you one day go to school. Once we have a bigger farm and we raise some crops from that farm, we will sell that and pay your school fees for you to go to school. So I was always hopeful. At the age of six, and I was exposed to some child labor and working very hard on the farm with my parents and with other people in the community. Every morning, I would wake up and go to the farm to help to, you know, send the birds away from the farm so that they do not eat our crops. I did that for a couple of years, and then at the age of eight, you know, Sierra Leone had the civil war by then. You know, but the war was purely in the urban areas, in the cities, in Freetown, Bo, and all the bigger cities. But by then we are living in the village. So at the age of eight, that war finally reached our village. And they reached in our village, they destroyed the village, they burned some houses, they burned our house down, and they captured some of the men and women and children in the village. They asked them to be converted into child soldiers, some of the children, and the men to be part of them as well. And the women were used for so many other purposes, you know, can imagine. And they went into the bushes to look for some of the other men and families that have gone to the forest to do their farming. And that's where I was captured together with my parents and my mom and dad. And they captured us, and I was asked to become a child soldier, which I refused. And my dad was asked to join them to be a rebel, which he refused. And, you know, they started, you know, shooting a lot of other people around that. And during that interim, I lost my dad as well. My dad, I lost my dad, and I got separated from the other extended family members, my mom and other people that we are all from the village. I got separated from them. So, but I ended up spending a couple nights in the couple months in the bush, 2 months in the bush with different people from the village. And we found our way to the city. I was going to the city to look for my uncle, who was a tailor living in the city in Bo. So, but he was not there because he had left by then to go look for us in the village because he heard that the rebels have reached our village. So we grew cross path. We could not see each other. And then I spent some time. He could not find him. And we spent some time on the street for a year. And then finally, one night, I was rescued with other children and taken into an orphanage called the Child Rescue Center. And I was among the first set of children that we are rescued from the street after the war and brought into that orphanage called the Child Rescue Center. And, you know, there I grew up with so many other children and then went to school and college and finished college and came back and picked up a job with the same organization, with the same orphanage, and I became the director of the orphanage over time. And then, yeah, so that's all how I went. And since then, I became a director, and I helped to lead the transition, working with the partners, helping children worldwide, based in Chantilly, Virginia, and then with the United Methodist Church in Sierra Leone and the UNICEF and the government agencies, for them to say, you know, the best place for these children to grow will be with a forever family. So we're able to help to lead the transition to send those children back to their various families across, so that they stop living in orphanage and move to family-based care. So since then, I have fallen in love with the work I do, and just being part of supporting children, supporting vulnerable children, vulnerable families across the globe.
Yeah, there is so much there. That's a couple decades, or more than a couple decades, in a few minutes right there. But there's so much there that we could spend days talking about all the different things. But there's a few things that I want to, really focus on as we have this conversation today. And one of those things is, you talked about just your amazing story. I mean, that the story, there's so much more to it, obviously. You can only, if you're given a summary, you only get just snippets of what God has done, mm-hmm. and the different things, and just the pain and the trauma and everything that's there. And I know that you're not even able to share all of it, because it does bring back some of that. And, that's something that we need to, obviously respect, but also, know that there's so much more to it. But also know that God has healed you in a lot of those things, and enough to be able to do what you're doing today, which, He does.
He does. But
some of the questions I want to just focus on today, and some of the things I want to focus on today, really are, you had the trauma as a child, and you went to the rescue center, right? And when you were there at the orphanage, with the conditions of the orphaned heart that you had at that point, because both you had lost both your parents at that point, as far as you knew, right? What were you feeling as a child when you were there, when you were on the streets, when you were rescued, when you were brought into this orphanage? What were you feeling as, the child in those situations?
Well, yeah, that's a good one. And, not only me, together with the other children, but of course, initially when I went to the orphanage, honestly, I had a lot of, nights of nightmares, terrible nightmares, and, still imagine from what I have had experienced in the war and on the streets and the bush in the forest, and with my dad passing away and losing track of my other family members. He didn't know that whether they were even alive or not, and got separated from them. So I had a lot of, series of nightmares, and kept taking me to churches. The village, the orphanage mothers kept taking me to churches to pray. And so eventually I became a little better with that. But initially when I went to the orphanage, with so many other children, we are very sad. We are still afraid because of what we have seen just coming from the war. But as time went on, they came and told us that we are going to go to school. And I was amazed. I was moved because, as I said, education was really on my agenda. I always wanted to go to school. So when they told us that, hey, we are coming to send you guys to school. So that was on a Monday. And that's why I love Mondays, really. That's kind of a weird thing about me. I love Mondays. Mondays are always my best days. I know most people don't like Mondays. But I was, that was on a Monday morning. They told us, you guys are going to school today. They've already brought our uniforms. They wanted to surprise us. It was so great, and I felt so good about it. So I said, okay. So that helped to take away some of the trauma, some of the experiences I've had, and because it playing with other children, and we started moving together, and they started providing so many things in the orphanage. Initially, it was very, very good. It was very good when we went to the orphanage. Mm-hmm. It was very good. There's no lie about that. They were meeting all our physical needs, mm-hmm. To see whether we are sad or why smiling or why we're drawn. They will see all of those things. We are eating 3 meals a day. I was not eating 3 meals a day when I was living out there on the street, but we started eating 3 meals a day, and all the meals had the correct proportion of food diet. They have, their mm-hmm. meat and chicken and fish and everything. Great. And then we had 24 hours of electricity, power supply. We had enough time to watch movies, watch them to to play kind of thing. And then we had a playground. And, you know, we have street supervision and care. We have pipe on water. We have showers to, you know. So all those things we never benefited from. We had them in the orphanage by then. So we are loving it. We are liking it. We are like, this is like a small, it's like a small heaven. It's like, you know, it's a very fancy place. You know, but as time went on, as we started growing, you know, getting older in the orphanage, we started realizing, we started asking, you know, typical question, because the orphanage was more concerned about the physical needs. They met all the physical needs. Mm-hmm. But see, somehow, somewhere, we felt empty inside. The emotional needs were not met. The physical looks, the sad face, the clothes, the food, they were drawn, they will see that. But the inside looks, we started asking what was really going inside of us. Feeling loved, feeling confused, feeling detached, feeling connected, asking relevant questions like, am I safe? Am I loved? Can I do things for myself? Am I capable? Do I belong? Like, am I respected? Am I included? Are my thoughts really valued? Am I understood? Do I matter in society? Because when we started going to school, there are some negative connotations attached to, because we are coming from an orphanage. Mm-hmm. Because it is in, you know, when people come from orphanage over the years, they always think that these are like, they refer to us as nobody's children, like no one's children. Like, see, we just fell from the sky somewhere and they picked us up. So we are always being a little bit segregated, you know, against in school. When something will come up in school, the other students will try to push us aside. They will think, oh, they don't know. They know nothing. These people are just in the orphanage. They are behind the closed walls. We didn't feel, they were not like including us in some of the basic social activities going on. You know, we only get to come on to the light when we perform very well in school. When the test results are out, if we come to do very well, if we do very well in at math or English or something, or one of the subjects, they will notice us. But besides that, we are hardly noticed in the communities around the schools. And because we are living in the orphanage, but we are attending public schools with other children who are not living in the orphanage. So there was always some kind of segregation. We are not kind of embraced to be like everyone else. So we felt that pinch. So it was not really a matter of just a tip of an iceberg wherein you see only a snip of the iceberg on the surface of the water. But the rest, the huge chunk of the iceberg is underneath the water. Mm-hmm. So the underneath the water, you don't see that. You only see what is on top. So in the orphanage, you are seeing everything that was on top. But really on the bottom, what was really underneath? Why were we sad? How are we feeling? What questions are we asking? What burning desires? What effort? Were they making effort to trace our families or children, or, you know, connections? So all those questions that they kept coming. So there are some areas of that. The orphanage was good. It was a little bit, you know, like somehow deceptive, because like the average life in Sierra Leone was different from when we are living in the orphanage. Mm-hmm. Everything was provided. Sierra Leone is a country that half of the population lives on less than $1.25 a day. They do not have constant electricity. Only 2% of the population has access to electricity. They do not have pipe-borne water. Majority of the people do not have that. So where we are living there, we have all these facilities. And the outside world was not having that. Mm-hmm. And so when I left the orphanage to other children, it was so hard for us to really, really adapt to the society. It was difficult. It was difficult.
Well, it's so good to hear from Nabs. If you guys have ever had the opportunity to meet Nabs or to hear him speak, he is just inspiring. And not only because of his experience, which he shared, of his time growing up in an orphanage, but because he didn't allow those experiences, that experience of being separated from his family, he didn't allow it to get him down. He just has such incredible enthusiasm and is really professionalized even now as he stepped into that role, starting with his role running the children's home later on, leading them through transition. and now really just coming up to be a premier leader, you know, within the care reform space. So we're just so thankful for this. Two quick notes, you know, as we just kind of reflect on NABS's story and what he was sharing. One, you know, we're going to do a few more of these compilation episodes. And next week, or I guess 2 weeks from now, our next episode, we're actually going to be looking at transitioning to family care. So as you heard, and you can even go back and listen to the previous episode with NABS, which was episode 141 of the Think Orphan podcast, we would love to invite you guys back next week, where we're going to be hearing from other leaders that have also led through transition, whether that's looking at the global movement around deinstitutionalization or care reform, whatever you want to call it, talking with Delia, and then looking at a country level, talking with Jonathan Dowell, and then looking at the organizational level with Spencer Reeves. So that's what we're going to be going through in a couple weeks. So please come back and definitely check out NABS's previous episode. Speaking of checking out other episodes, would love to give a shout out to NABS and our friends at Helping Children Worldwide. NABS, along with a dear friend and colleague, Dr. Laura Horvath, have just started their own podcast called Optimistic Voices, where they're looking at some of these things. Their first episode, they actually had Dan Hope on the episode, who is, of course, a friend of the podcast, doing great work at SFAC. Would love to encourage you guys to check out Optimistic Voices as well, so you can hear more from NABS, from Dr. Laura Horvath, not Dr. Laura Schlesinger, however you say her name. It's Dr. Laura Horvath with NABS, doing great work and sharing some stories over at Optimistic Voices. Okay, enough about NABS, though. We love him. But we're going to get into this next podcast, which, to be honest, this was my favorite episode that we have ever done. Even as a listener to Think Orphan, I feel like this blows every other one out of the water, if I could be that biased. Earlier this year, we had Sunette Chan and Grace and Jerry on the podcast, and it was phenomenal. So if you guys would like to check out that episode, we encourage you to go back and check out the episode with Sunette and Grace. But we're going to get into it right here, and are excited for you guys to hear their stories. And it's really, really inspiring and encouraging. So we talk about care leaving and how challenging that was, but you actually experienced multiple types of orphanages. What was that like from the inside?
So the it's bad and good, but I can say that I was I experimented by myself, because I experienced living in the bad orphanage almost 10 years in my from 9 to 17, and then I moved to the good orphanage. But during in the bad orphanage, I was exploitation, and I was work in the hard labor, looking after the cow, growing vegetable farm, and many more work, and all the profit is going to the market, and all the money is going to the director pocket. And during that time, we work, but no one really care if you are sick, you have enough food to eat, or clean water to drink. Sometimes we drink very dirty water from the water valley. And when we get sick, they just left the kids on the floor and get healed by themselves. And lucky enough, And I forgot to mention, during that time, we was very bad neglect, because the director of the orphanage physically abused us. I was raped by the director of the orphanage. I said this a lot of time, because I want to mention that it's okay to say it. When I was young, I'm so scared to tell all my my caregiver that I was raped. I was so embarrassed and ashamed. But right now, I feel I need to talk about it, And it's okay to say it and don't feel ashamed about it. And later on, I moved to the good orphanage and the best care, but still I feel lonely and like feeling abandoned and seeking for love and trust, but still I can't find.
Yeah. Sunette, first of all, I'm just so sorry about all of these things that you underwent. And, you know, for somebody like me, right? So I used to work at a children's home. I worked at a children's home for 2.5 years in East Africa, realized that, and it was more like the good orphanage, right? Where the people were more caring, but recognized, you know, this isn't the best way. There could be better ways, right? To care for kids. But we talk about some of these things. And we've had people that have come on the podcast and have said, you know, there's exploitation in orphanages or, you know, the prevalence of sexual abuse is there. But for you to come on and, I mean, just, I don't think we've ever had something like that quite before. So Sunette, thank you for your bravery even. I mean, that's just really remarkable. And thank you for advocating on behalf of children that are still in those exploitative situations, right? It's just remarkable.
And I want to mention that there is no good orphanage. There is no good orphanage. And no excuse, you know, no excuse. There is no good orphanage. And you need to put all those vulnerable children in the orphanage in the good, like in the hope of good future. I experienced it myself. And I also working with the care leaver, and 10, like 9 of them, they are experiencing like, you know, a horrible life, even in the good orphanage. So no excuse.
Yeah. Thank you, Sunette. And Grace, I would love to hear from you as well. You are not Cambodian. You are Kenyan, joining us from East Africa, but also have a care experience story. Would you just share maybe with us just a little bit about your own story, your upbringing, and what it was like, even when you exited care?
Sure. Thank you, Brandon, for having me. And sorry, Sunette, for the childhood traumas you also experienced. It's heartbreaking. Yeah. For me, my story is not as heartbreaking as Sunette, but it's also a unique story, in that I was able to experience family life for quite a long time before I was enrolled in a residential care. So how my story began is, as I was clearing my primary school level, I was in search of high school support for education. And so I got enrolled to this CCI, whereby in exchange of being supported for my education. And so I spent part of my childhood with my family, my mother. And I used to, in my primary school, I used to see the children from the CCI that I was admitted to. And I will see, wow, they're so privileged in that they have, the care they were being given, provided for meals, their school uniform being catered for, whereas for us it was contrary to that. So there was that bit that we used to adore them, you know. But then the moment when I was told I will join the CCI, I was in a limbo, in that I didn't really want to go, but I needed the support. So I had the feelings of stigmatization, in that the way the society views children in CCIs come from orphan. They are mostly orphans. So I had that same idea, and I was like, so how is it about me? I'm not an orphan. Why should I also be placed in a CCI? So, and this happened when I was still a teenager, you know, whereby you also have changes happening in your body, trying to identify yourself. And at that point, I remember I completely changed, in that my social relations did change completely, because I had friends from my childhood and I cut off those friendships immediately. I was admitted in care. So being in care also was not smooth because there was a lot of discrimination happening, mostly based on who knows who. So that also happened. But later on with life after high school, I managed to clear. And yeah, it was the moment for me to exit. So they took me back home to my family. The other thing, the expectation that we had is that, you know, they took you and gave you this hope of supporting your education. And for me, I was good in studies, so I performed well. And I was so sure they will also cater for my university fees. And to my surprise, it didn't happen. And why it didn't happen? I was linked up with my sponsor who schooled me in high school. And when I reached out to her, she said, didn't know I, that's when I actually opened her that right now I'm home with my mom and my brother. And so she was also shocked because the story she had of me so that she got to support me was that I was an orphan. So she was shocked that I had actually a family. And she did cut the sponsorship and she was not able to support my higher education. So that is how it was. And it was really tough for me in that I was so hopeful that I really at once got some hope of pursuing my education with great hope, but I wasn't. It was cut short. Luckily enough, since I performed well, I did take a loan from the government and I was able to process my education to completion, my degree. So that is all about.
No, that's so good, Grace. And it's actually really important for us to juxtapose, you know, there are different care leaver stories. And the piece around education with yours, Grace, is quite, I think it happens more often than people realize and almost creates like an incentive for kids to go into children's homes. But it's really fascinating to juxtapose, you know, these two stories. So thank you both for sharing.
Can you share with us about the issues facing vulnerable children in Cambodia? And what are some of the reasons that children become separated from their families?
Most important thing is poverty, being poor, and not have education. Right now, we face that because in parent mind, like traditional Cambodian parent mind, they think that only to have education for their children only is to go to an orphanage. Because in Cambodia, when I was young, like the orphanage director will drive his car, go around to village and village, talking to the parents saying that if you give your children to my orphanage, I will give the important education to your children. And then when they finish school, I will support them with the job, and then they can provide, you know, like salary back to their family. And because their parents uneducated, and they believe the director of the orphanage, that is why they send the children. And back then, it's just my like my childhood mind and memory. But when I work now, when I work with those children and the community and the society, I can see that, you know, in Cambodia, we experience Khmer Rouge, right? And we start after that year, we start all over again. And everyone is trying to survive. And there is a lot of orphan, but they are real orphan. But now it is, at that time, they build orphanage. Yes, we need it during that time. But now it's 40 years already, and there is no more orphan, like real orphan. It's just uneducated and being poor. So that is why they separated from their family and like in the trick, you know, in a trap of belief in higher education, you need to go to orphanage.
What is it about the orphanages that basically make you lose your identity?
Sure. I'd actually start with my own experience. Like prior joining the CCI, I was so much involved with my church, the youth activities. I was so active in that. And when I joined, it was the moment of my adolescence. So I'm being changed to the normal society that I was used to, despite the changes happening in my body of trying to know, you know, the transition to adulthood. It's also a new transition that you also, as a young person, get to juggle around. So that is one. And now when you're in this CCI, first of all, you don't practice the same faith you used to practice. You have to adopt to the new faith that is being practiced. Why is that so? Most of the CCIs sometimes find it easier to just have you under one religion. So that's one. People get to lose their own religious beliefs. The other bit is also in terms of also the relationship you had with your family. Yeah, so the ties you had. I know of experiences from close caregivers of mine that, yes, they know their relatives, but you don't even want to be associated with them. You feel like, I don't belong to them. You know, I belong to my own self. I have my own small world, and that is it. Even if you have any personal troubles, you'd rather approach any other stranger other than reaching out to you. Of family members sometimes who are even able to help you out. So you've been disconnected from the people who you share blood with. So that is something else that it pulls you from your own identity. And even culturally, you know, a language, ways of cooking, and so it gets lost along the way. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Sunette, do you have anything to add to that?
Similar to Grace, but when I was at the orphanage, I experienced like seeing volunteer coming and going into my life, out of my life, like every day. And like you can imagine all the, you know, like many volunteer or donor supporter come from around the world, and like American, French, Japan, Chinese, and yes, many more Australian. And imagine all those people come from with different culture, nationality, and, you know, so speaking different language, and they come to see us every day, and we are Khmer and Cambodian. And when they come to see us, they didn't like see us as a Cambodian. They see us as one of them, you know. They didn't speak our language. They didn't want to hear our culture or tasting our own food. They share us all their, you know, like their culture and everything they own. And when we go out to our society to live in independent or living an orphanage, our society wouldn't accept us, didn't accept us, because they thought that, you know, you are one of those foreigner, you know, like the way you dress up, the way you speak, your mind, you know, you are not one of us. And that is very difficult. That is why we see the gap of, you know, the generation to one generation. They are trying to find themselves. That is why a lot of caregivers, when they go out to live independent, they are struggle to find themselves, to know about themselves. And that is why, like, that is can be a reason they fell into depression, anxiety, and, you know, later on fell into drug, alcoholic, or, you know, sometimes they take their own life.
So that was just the tip of the iceberg with that amazing conversation that we had with Sunette Chan and Grace and Jerry. I would really invite you and encourage you, if you haven't heard it or if you need to hear it again, go back and check out episode 189 to hear the whole conversation that we had with Sunette and Grace, because it was very meaningful to both Phil and I. You know, one of the things that we really see in their story is that variance, right? Here you have, you know, a situation where a kid becomes separated in Cambodia versus a situation in Kenya. There's different things that are in play. There's abuse, which we heard about. There's education. There's push factors. There's pull factors. As we think about NABS, as we think about Sunette, as we think about Grace, and as we think about our next guest, Tomrat, you'll notice that, you know, these are four different countries, you know, four different areas of the world. And yet each of these stories have some similarities, and they also have some variants. So that episode that we did with Sunette and Grace is a great place to go and kind of see some of those intricacies. It really is important when we talk about child-centric models of caring for kids that we really are willing to get into the nitty-gritty and the intricacies of each kid's story, and just appreciate the way that Sunette and Grace really modeled that. You know, I just want to acknowledge one of the things that Sunette was getting into around abuse, and she was, I don't even really have a word, even after recording that months ago, to express the magnitude of her vulnerability, you know, in that, and how she is using even that severe trauma that she went through to advocate on behalf of vulnerable kids. Abuse is real. Abuse happens when we're talking about orphan care, when we're talking about kids that are growing up in orphanages or kids growing up in families. Abuse is real. Sexual abuse is real. Sexual violence is real. It's something that we've talked about on the podcast before, and it's one of the things that people are really looking at. Recently, I was able to be on a podcast called Theology in the Raw with Preston Sprinkle. And for him and a lot of his listeners, as people that were maybe not as informed as our listeners are, because our listeners are practitioners and experts and leaders and, you know, foster parents, and, you know, our audience is very informed around these issues. So we know the reality of abuse. But for people outside that, when we say, hey, it's best for kids to grow up in families, that tends to be one of the things that they are most concerned about, is saying, well, if we send kids back into family, isn't there a likelihood of abuse? And of course, we have to acknowledge that there's always that potential, right? But we also have to recognize that children that are growing up in residential care, especially when those child protection and safeguarding mechanisms are not in place, they're at even higher risk. And that was something that Preston was kind of grilling me about. And I would just encourage you guys, if you guys are looking at that abuse piece, if you guys are trying to make a case, you know, like needed to be made evident in Sunette's situation, as she conveyed in our conversation with her, you know, reach out to us. After my conversation on Theology in the Raw, I reached out to our friend Ellie Oswald, who provided some great studies as far as the prevalence of abuse in residential care. And we want to make this case, right? And we want to make this case as it pertains to abuse in residential care, not because we want to shame anybody, not by any stretch, but because we do want to have that evidence base to say it really is best and safest for kids to be growing up in a family. And even when a kid's going through adversity, we don't want to change the context for their care setting away from family. We just want to mitigate the risk factors that they're facing there. So I just kind of wanted to throw that in there. We are going to get into our next and final segment for this episode, talking with Tomrat Kabede. Brother, you know I love you. I hope I pronounced your last name right. Tamra is doing great work at Salamta Family Project in Ethiopia. He's a care leaver himself, and now leading a ministry around alternative family care. And, you know, as I had mentioned, we're going to be doing a few of these compilations. And one of the ones that we will be getting into is conflict. And in Tamrat's episode, he actually talks about the conflict in Ethiopia right now. And we heard this in Nabs's conversation as well. So keep that in mind, because we're going to be coming back to that in a couple episodes. But right now, we're going to get into our conversation with Tamrat.
But what were some of the components of living in an orphanage that an average person outside the orphanage might not realize? And what were some of the harder parts about growing up in an orphanage?
Let me begin with that. So some of the hardest part growing up in the orphanage is that you don't have hope. Like, you're just there through a program. So there is no talk about having your own family. There was corporal punishment in most cases. That was brutal and unthinkable. So there was no psychosocial support. You kind of figure out life on your own, sometimes hitting a wall. That's how I would express it. Like, you hit the wall and you learn, oh, it's there. But you have no whatsoever guidance, like, other than getting you fed or clothing and getting to school. So those were not being done intentionally. I didn't have any psychosocial support. I don't remember having any counseling with all traumas that I have walked through in life. So that's been mostly the toughest experience I had in the orphanage. Most people don't realize that kids in the orphanage are created in the image of God. I mean, we are kids who've gone through trauma, some sort of trauma, some walk of life that are very difficult. And people don't understand that. So because of our behavior, people misjudge us, saying different things. They don't understand that we had once a family, and that we are created in the image of God, and we do have that dignity God created us with. So most people don't realize that in most cases. They see us very differently. Even coming out of the orphanage, going to school, everybody points at you saying, here comes that orphan child. So they make you feel bad, or they make you feel kind of responsible for what has happened in life, when actually it's different otherwise. So those are like things people don't understand about us, like orphans. We're not created to be necessarily violent or aggressive or stuff. It's things that have had in our life expressed that way, because we are not in control of that. It's there within us as we were brought up early in our childhood. So that's something people don't understand. So people should understand that we are uniquely made and wonderfully made by God, just like any human beings. We are not that different. It's just some of our past experience, some have shaped some of our behaviors. But if there is a good intervention in that, that could possibly turn out to be very good.
So what would you say are ways, and, you know, we talked a lot about this in the In Pursuit of Orphan Excellence book, because I was able to write with a bunch of co-authors in the past. The orphan stigma that you just referred to there, you know, you go to school and it's, oh, there's the orphan kids, or there's the, you know, like you said, it's almost a second rate human. And how can we reverse that? How can we help people understand that? What are the steps? And I know you guys are doing this, some of the stuff you're doing in Salamta, but what are the things that we can do to help people understand that people are people, no matter, you know, what labels we like to put on people, whether it's in India with the caste system, whether it's what you're talking about with the orphan, what are ways we can do that practically in our world?
Yeah, I would say, I think it will be great to have people involved in the orphan care program, whether it's through the church or through any other organizations that are involved in this. I think getting this right message to the people would help that everybody is created in the image of God. And yes, sin has interrupted or disrupted that image to some extent, but even worse, it's what happens in the socio-economic and in the socio-political stuff that creates most of these problems. So we are meant to be having families that we call our own. So if there is a wrap around care support that comes from families, individuals, or organizations into the orphan care system, I think that will change. And getting people trained on TBRI and trauma-informed care, those I think will be very helpful to get that out to societies and people to have a better perspective that we are no different than anyone else on this planet. Yeah. But helping families or societies understand, change those circumstances that create orphan world, I think would be very helpful in changing the mindset.
Well, after hearing four people, Nab, Sunette, Grace, and Tomrat, I don't really feel like I need to say a whole lot more. I feel like Tomrat summed it up really well. We want to love these kids. We want to give these kids opportunity to be safe from harm. We want to give these kids opportunity to grow up within family. And for those of us that are working in this space and are not care experienced, myself included, we really need to prioritize listening and learning from those that have grown up in care. And that's what this episode has been all about. There's so much that we can learn about. You know, Tomrat was just talking about how difficult it was for him to really grow up in a different culture. Earlier, Sunette was talking about abuse. And Grace was talking about the need for education. Nabs actually said the same thing. So we're getting these different examples, and it's all from lived experience. We have to absolutely be listening to people that have exited care, and I would just even say, you know, children and youth that are currently in care, right? We're talking with adults today, but we need to be listening and talking to kids that are actively in care settings as well. So I would just encourage you guys to go back and check out these different episodes. And we look forward to sharing some more of this content over the next couple months. And as we head into the fall, we'll of course get back to our normal format of interviewing leaders within orphan care. But we're just so grateful for all of you listening, following along, and we hope that you take everything that you are hearing here on Think Orphan, that you use it to love and to serve orphan and vulnerable children more and more with excellence every single day. Thanks so much, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.
We hope you've enjoyed today's Think Orphan podcast. For all the information in this week's podcast, please visit us at thinkorphan.com. You too can be part of the conversation. Send your questions to info@thinkorphan.com or join us on the Think Orphan Facebook page. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us again on the next edition of Think Orphan.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. To serve others in ways that promote human flourishing and create a ripple effect of transformation for generations to come. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At caskers.com, we make this experience easy.
Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at caskers.com.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.